At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Our lead story today in seven little letters, AMZN and NYT. Those are ticker symbols. Y'all look them up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, today the 17th of August. Great, as always, to have you along, everybody. You know, the news cycle these days is such that for a story to dominate the general conversation for more than, about a nanosecond, it feels like, is a rare thing indeed. But the story in the New York Times this weekend about Amazon and its workplace culture has made quite the splash, I think it's fair to say. Tales of uncaring managers and workers being pitted against their colleagues in a cutthroat environment. Jody Kantor shared the byline on the story in the paper. Jody, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What made this company worth the investment that the Times made in this piece? Because you guys were doing this for 6 months or something, right?
We realized that so many of us know Amazon as consumers, but not that many of us knew about the fascinating workplace that Jeff Bezos has created inside the corporate Seattle offices, a workplace that they boast is peculiar, that is really different from other places, that consciously rejects a lot of the rules that often govern office life, and yet at the same time gives us a glimpse of what the future of the workplace may be like.
A lot in that answer, which we're going to break down sort of in due course here. First of all, it is fascinating. Yes, as you said, it is also, as you led listeners and readers to believe in this piece, it's miserable there. I mean, it's terrible.
Not for everybody, but they do pride themselves on being a tough culture. You know, Bezos tells people this is a culture of working incredibly hard. They use the phrase unreasonably high to describe their standards and expectations. And a former Amazon director of human resources said that the company basically works on purposeful Darwinism is the phrase that she used. And the idea there is that they're really trying to get everybody to work as hard and be productive as they absolutely can. It comes out of Jeff Bezos's fears of becoming slack as a large company.
And it's not new, this ethos. I mean, Bezos, as you point out in this article, has been talking about this almost since the beginning, doing things that are hard and working people hard to get there.
And by many measures, it is very successful. People say is that part of Amazon's success can be attributed to the fact that he's basically invented a way of getting the most out of every employee. And talking to employees is fascinating because nobody is making these people work there. These are not $12 an hour workers who don't have other options. These are fairly elite, decently well compensated workers. And what they talk about in interviews is how the Amazon system made them want to drive themselves.
To quote Don Draper from Mad Men, I think early in the series, that's what the money's for.
It is. And it's also important to point out that there are a lot of things that employees say they really like about working at Amazon. It's a culture of innovation. There isn't a lot of red tape. Relatively junior people can have a lot of responsibility. I found that in most of our interviews, we were talking to people who really loved aspects of working with the company, but they were struggling with this kind of punishing culture.
Well, give me some specifics, because there are things in this article that you point out that Amazon does. For example, very strict new employee orientation, its customs, its rules. I mean, lots of companies have those. We have those here, and I'm sure the Times does too.
Oh, of course. Let me talk about a couple of things that Amazon does that's really unique. team members are ranked against each other. It's a very competitive atmosphere. It's not the only company to use this kind of system, but many companies have abandoned it. And at Amazon, it's particularly direct because, for example, you can send secret negative feedback about your peers to your peers' bosses. The bosses see who it's from, but other workers don't necessarily see it. Another very tough thing is that the evaluation system is fairly relentless, and we weren't looking for this in particular, but we found a real pattern of people who had life crises when they were at Amazon. They had cancer, their parents died, they had really bad pregnancy loss, and what they said is that the company did not give them time to recover, and they felt that the company was so relentless that they couldn't pause and get back on their feet.
Could Amazon be Amazon, do you think? And could we get whatever we want when we want it, maybe even almost before we know we want it, without this kind of culture at the company?
That is the question. And because you're asking a hypothetical and not something that can be reported, I certainly can't answer. But, you're asking the very thing that our sources were grappling with. These were people who were really devoted to a lot of what the company did. And also, what's the cost? What's the cost in turnover? What's the cost in human pain? Would I be, in a sense, even more motivated if this place made me feel better about working there?
Well, so let me ask you something that can be reported, and I will offer my own answer first. I am an Amazon Prime member. I pay my $99, and I order stuff, and I want it the next day. Are you an Amazon Prime member?
Oh, I am. Absolutely. Right. Part of what was fascinating about reporting this article was hearing the back end of how that all happens. And especially in the retail division, you learn about the coordination, the pinpoint timing, the accountability that gets all that stuff to our doorstep so quickly. For example, one of the scariest things that can happen to you if you work in the retail division is that you can be brought to account for a quote-unquote cold prickly.
Yeah.
That's an Amazon term for when an email has to go out to a customer saying, "Dear little Timmy, I'm really sorry to tell you that your Christmas toy is not going to arrive because we had an inventory problem or we had a shipping problem or whatever, whatever." Amazon is so customer-focused that that is like the worst thing that can happen at Amazon. And employees talk about that with an upside and a downside. The upside is that they really like that the company is so devoted to satisfying consumers. What they don't like is they say that there is a harshness with which employees are brought to account, that they feel that they are grilled and that it's not okay to just sometimes say, "I don't know," or "I have to look into that more."
That gets to the pushback that this piece has received, which has been extraordinary. I don't even know how many thousands of comments on the New York Times website. And Jeff Bezos has, as you reported today and others have, come out with a letter, not doing a point-by-point rebuttal, but basically saying, no, Amazon's not that kind of company. There was an internal guy who wrote his own thing on LinkedIn, which has been shared a gazillion times. What do you make of the high-level response that this has gotten about what Amazon is?
I'm not sure I would define it all as pushback. The comments have been very varied. The Bezos letter was fascinating because he led, first of all, with telling everyone to read our article. And he also said the kind of callous management practices that the story described are not to be tolerated at Amazon. And if anybody experiences them, please contact me or HR immediately. He did go on to say that it's not the Amazon he recognized. So yes, it is true that there was a really interesting article on LinkedIn defending the company. It was from a guy who's worked there 18 months. The Amazonians I've talked to have sort of mixed feelings about what he wrote because some of it seems right to them, some of it doesn't seem right to them. He was very dismissive, for example, of gender concerns. Right. He said the company does not cull people every year, which it most certainly does. And so I think what we're seeing is we're almost getting a little glimpse of the internal debate that plays out inside Amazon and has for a long time. For so many of the people we talked to in the article, they themselves were debating the Amazon way only within the context of their own lives. Is this right for me? The rewards of this company are so great. Do I want to play by these rules? And I think what's happened now is that the article has helped bring that debate into the open. So it's not only an Amazon worker sitting with, her husband talking about those issues, but it's now more of a public conversation.
Jody Kantor, with her colleague David Streitfeld, has the big buzzy piece in the New York Times the past couple of days. It's called Inside Amazon. Jody, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
Amazon is a retailer, yes, but it's also a big and influential tech company, which has a lot of people asking questions about workplace culture in Silicon Valley, broadly speaking here. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that slice of this story.
You won't find serious business leaders excusing Amazon for accounts of employees being mistreated while recovering from health and family issues. But as for stories of long hours and high pressure, those aren't exactly unusual in the tech world.
They put people in jobs that deplete them incredibly, and just have this general sense of just work focus in an enormous number of hours. And that's just how it is across the industry.
And as Stanford management professor Bob Sutton points out, dreadful hours are not something tech companies invented.
You look at what you do with new doctors. I mean, remember, the hours they work is incredible. What you do with new lawyers, management consultants, people at financial services firms.
But more so than any other industry, tech companies pride themselves on constant innovation. And they want us to believe they're these progressive places that shower their workers with free food and swanky gyms. But even those perks reinforce long hours, says David Auerbach, veteran of Google and Microsoft.
The perks vary from company to company, but where they exist are generally designed to, you know, keep you from leaving so that you work harder.
But a caffeine-fueled culture that works for a young tech company may not serve a giant public firm. Catherine Phillips is Senior Vice Dean of Columbia Business School.
Many of these companies find it more difficult when people start to get older and have families and children and things like this. The culture might not exactly fit.
With tech companies aiming to be global powerhouses and needing grown-ups to help them get there, they may face more hard questions about their workplace cultures. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
We're collecting stories about office culture, both good and bad. Leave us yours on our Facebook page. We're Marketplace APM if you get there. On Wall Street today, slow start, strong finish. Both AMZN and NYT did fine. Thank you very much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've been in and out of the city of New Orleans the past couple of weeks, looking back at what a decade of recovery from Hurricane Katrina feels like. With the old political adage, where you stand depends on where you sit, firmly in our minds, we've called the guy who sits in the mayor's office down there. Mitch Landrieu is now in his second term as the mayor of New Orleans. Mr. Mayor, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
You said in your State of the City speech a month or two ago that New Orleans is no longer rebuilding, no longer recovering. I'm guessing you're speaking metaphorically, right? Because there's construction going on all over the place down there.
Correct. I am speaking metaphorically. And I was trying to create a clarion call for the people of the city to not keep looking back, but to let's look forward, because our 300th anniversary will be upon us in a very short period of time on May 5th, 2018. And I want them to think about building the city for the future and not just about getting back to where we were before Katrina hit.
Here's one of those things I imagine you're going to say you have to work on. The population is back to something like 94% of what it was the day before the storm hit, yet the city is whiter and wealthier than it used to be. Does that bother you at all?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't say it like that because it's not an accurate reflection. I would say a couple of things. When Katrina hit, although we lost a large number of people then, we actually lost more people over the 40 and 50 years before that. So as we think about rebuilding, we don't want to be parochial. We want more people to move in. The city of New Orleans before the storm was major, majority African-American city. It is a little bit less so than it was before, but we've had Hispanic brothers and sisters move in. We've had people from around the country move in. It's a more eclectic city than it was before, but there's no hint or no chance that the city of New Orleans has ever lost its historical character or its essence as a gumbo. And so I'm not really concerned about New Orleans changing, because there's no way that if you move here that you're going to change us before we change you. And the culture of New Orleans is so strong that it's something that should be enjoyed by everybody.
A lot of the people we talk to in our reporting down there, and we've had producers and reporters down there for 6 or 8 weeks now, a lot of them who are business people say, you know what, it was a rough rebuild. And if this happens again to New Orleans, I'm not sure I'd stick it out and do it again.
Well, I got bad news for you. If any city got their hump busted like New Orleans, it would be a tough rebuild. So instead of thinking about, oh, New Orleans has to get out of the way, what the country needs to be thinking about is what's going to happen when it hits us, and how can we protect ourselves, and how can we learn from New Orleans? Katrina was not a natural disaster. We were fine when Katrina came in and then Katrina left. It wasn't until the levees broke, which is an infrastructure failure. That wasn't a natural disaster failure. That was a federal government investment failure. And the country ought to be thinking about the fact that Congress can't even pass an infrastructure investment bill and the need for that so that we can be a stronger nation. New Orleans is just a canary in the coal mine as it relates to that.
Census Bureau calls you guys the fastest growing, says you guys are the fastest growing major city in the country. Is that necessarily a good thing?
Well, I mean, you know, growing has its pains and shrinking has its pains. As long as you grow well, it can be a good thing. You know, of course it's better when people want to come in. If property values have gone up, you're getting more jobs, you're producing children that are doing better in school, people that are healthier, the economy's rising, those are always good things. That generally invites more people, but it's really about how you manage it, not whether you're big or you're small.
Mitch Landrieu, the mayor of New Orleans, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Great. Thanks so much for having us. God bless.
Coming up.
They're neglecting their duties. I think it's pretty bad.
And yet one of them might be the next president of these United States. Our series, I've Always Wondered, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 67 points this Monday, 0.4%, 17,545 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ added 43 points, about 0.8%, 5,091. The S&P 500 up 10 points, 0.5%, 2102 there. Deal of the day, Liberty Interactive, owner of the QVC channel, buys Zulily, the flash sale site, for $2.4 billion. Liberty down 1.5%. Zulily up 49%. Go figure that one out. AMZN today up 0.7%. NYT up 1.5%. Of course, bears mention here that Amazon is a $530 stock. The New York Times is not. Not a great day for Chicago Bridge and Iron Company, which makes piping systems and other energy infrastructure, CB&I, as it's known, off 4.5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.16%. And you? Yes, you. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for July. Home Depot and Walmart are scheduled to issue quarterly earnings. And have you been celebrating National Catfish Month? You still have a couple of weeks. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I know it seems like a simple thing, but getting a pothole fixed is actually quite a complicated process. First of all, somebody, usually somebody in a city government someplace, has to know that there is a pothole. That's item one, right? Then the street needs to be inspected, the data analyzed about road usage and all that jazz, and then a decision made about how urgent the repair is. It is a time-consuming, expensive, and often inefficient process. But as Irina Jorov reports from Keystone Crossroads and WESA in Pittsburgh, technology could change that.
Christoph Mertz spends his days looking at cracks in the street.
Once you're involved in something like this, you see every crack in the road, every pothole, and said, this is interesting.
Mertz isn't an inspector. He's a researcher at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, and he's built a computer program that uses photos to detect cracks in pavement. He's been working with the city of Pittsburgh since the end of 2014 to test the technology. He's mounted cameras inside three city vehicles. He has one in his own car, too, and he takes me for a ride.
Okay, so let me get that app started. And then you just hit the start recording.
As he drives, the camera records the pavement unspooling in front of the car. Later, he'll upload the video to his computer and the program will analyze the data. It breaks the pavement in each picture into a grid.
It looks for texture. It looks for certain patterns. So an ideal road, a newly paved road, looks basically uniformly black. But the cracks, it will have a texture.
Roads are then scored based on how badly the surface is cracked. The city's inspectors do a similar analysis, but they use their eyes, which can be a problem, says Deputy Director of Public Works Lee Howler.
Each inspector is doing a fairly subjective inspection.
This manual process is also more expensive. Another problem? The city is responsible for 1,100 miles of streets. It takes the three part-time inspectors 4 to 5 years to review them. By the time that's all done, Howler says, there's a good chance much of the data is inaccurate.
After winter, the condition of a given street can change rapidly because what was just cracking after a number of freeze-thaw cycles turns into major potholes.
Howler says more current data would make planning easier and more effective. The city would be able to identify exactly which streets need work urgently and which ones can wait. American Society of Civil Engineers fellow Brian Leshko says the quality of city streets can have a big impact on its economy.
And that, you know, is not only just the public getting to and from work, which is very important, but it's also bringing goods and services.
Back at his lab at Carnegie Mellon, Mertz is still working out the kinks in the program. The algorithm can't always tell cracks from shadows, and he still hasn't developed it to recognize potholes, patches, or rutting. So his technology isn't perfect yet, but it could eventually be a game changer for cities like Pittsburgh with aging infrastructure and limited resources. In Pittsburgh, I'm Irina Zhurov for Marketplace.
From time to time on this program, we turn things over to you all, metaphorically speaking, of course, but you get the idea. It's the segment where our reporters answer your questions about those things in business and the economy that have always bewildered you. It's called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blatant.
Today's installment has a decidedly Washington angle to it. So from the nation's capital, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is on it.
Jim Brinson is a CPA in San Diego. He's a fan of the show, a fan of the series, but...
Some of the questions you guys have are really interesting, but it's nothing that I've ever really wondered about.
That changes today. Jim, what do you want to know?
With all of the current sitting congressmen and senators announcing their run for president, I've always wondered how they get away with campaigning. I would have to think that the campaigning gets in the way of their real job. How do they get so much time off? Do they still get paid full salary?
I put his question to Jay Hunter. He tracks members of Congress for CQ Roll Call.
They do not actually get time off, and they do get paid their full salary.
A salary of $174,000 a year. But are they earning it?
Especially this cycle, a lot of the current senators who are running for president have missed a lot of votes in 2015.
Hunter is a data cruncher and compared how often the campaigning senators showed up for votes this year compared to other members of their caucuses. He checked Bernie Sanders, Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, Rand Paul, and...
Thank you. God bless you.
Florida Senator Marco Rubio, heard here announcing his campaign in April. Rubio's missed almost a third of his votes this year, compared to the Senate Republican average of about 3%. I told that to Jim Brinson, and I don't think he'll be handing out any gold attendance stars.
Sorry, almost choked on my coffee.
Kentucky Senator Rand Paul has made almost all of his votes, but he's been criticized along with others for using the Senate floor as a campaign venue. Orrin Hatch has been in the Senate almost 40 years, and even he thinks it's getting out of control.
And we must ensure that the pernicious trend of turning the Senate floor into a forum for advancing personal ambitions, for promoting political campaigns, or for enhancing fundraising activities comes to a stop.
But does missing votes mean they're not doing their job? American University government professor Jennifer Lawless says not necessarily.
So as long as they have excellent staffs, both in their district and in Washington, the overwhelming majority of their work can still get done, even if they're on the presidential campaign trail.
She says most of the votes they miss are ones where their vote won't change the outcome. Plus, as long as an opponent doesn't bring up a poor voting record in a campaign, constituents usually don't care.
I asked Brinson if the stats and the extra info were enough to answer his question.
My curiosity, I guess, is satisfied, but I'm not satisfied.
They're neglecting their duties. I think it's pretty bad.
He still thinks the relatively unproductive Congress might get more done if its members spent less time campaigning and more time, you know, legislating. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This is one of those segments that does not work without you. We need to know what you have always wondered about, right? Yeah? So please tell us, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which fall this year will be just that little bit more genuine. The leaves will turn, the air will get crisp, and there will actually be pumpkin in your Starbucks pumpkin spice latte. It's true, I know. The company announced in a blog post today it's going to take the caramel coloring out, put the actual ingredient, pumpkin, in. Lest you think this is merely me being anti-pumpkin spice, here is the business angle from our friend Vanessa Wong at BuzzFeed, where we first saw this story. Since it was introduced in 2003, Starbucks has sold 200 million of those puppies at $4, maybe $5 a pop. You do the math. That's a big number, man. All righty, we're out of here. The Dow up 67 points today, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ put on 43 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 closed up 10 points. That is 0.5%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bondner, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.